Hello, I'm here during the lunch rush with Janice, who owns her own food truck.
Best cheesesteaks in town.
Janice traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for her food truck business. We're here where she needs us most.
They sure are.
We make it so easy for her to save, with customised coverage that grows with her business. Sorry, I just get so emotional talking about saving folks money.
Not this onion I'm chopping?
It's just so beautiful. Oh, yeah, nice, the onion.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff.
Ahoy, friends. Thank you for tuning into Truth and Justice. You are listening to the Friday follow-up for Season 17, Episode 12. This week, we heard Chris Bynum's second police statement and his, and I'm using air quotes, confession. This episode has stirred up a lot of listener questions and theories. We are sans Janet today, but Bob and I are here to get all your questions answered. But before we get into that, do we have any housekeeping?
One thing, and I don't have all the details. I actually got all the details. I haven't had time to process all the details yet, but Christian Smith from our Season 12 case, Opinions Pine case, his mom reached out to me today, and they're still going through all the habeas process through the state and through the federal, still waiting to get back in court. But she sent me some information where they want folks to write a letter. It looked for, again, I've been juggling all week. This week has been a busy week, you know, in the office here and at school, and we have conferences, so I just kind of glanced over it. But it looks like they're trying to petition to get them, Christian and Robert, resentenced.
Okay.
And they're asking for letters to be written that we'll send to the attorney to send in to whoever the powers that be are there. So I'm telling you that now so that later when I put this up, you know what I'm talking about, because I need to go process it all. She sent me like a format thing and all the information about it. So pay attention to my social media. For those that are in Facebook on the official Truth and Justice podcast fans page, I'll put a post up there when we have all the information. Probably put something out on X and Instagram as well to get as many people as we can to write letters, because that would be amazing if during the appeals process, if we're able to get a resentencing done and get it shortened or even maybe get them home. Again, I don't know the details of it. I just got the information, but I will be sharing that. So be on the lookout for that.
Oh, that would be huge. I hope we can get that done. Let's get this out there for them.
Yep. And I know everybody's asking about the West Memphis 3. Everything's at the lab. Testing's being done. So I'll let you know as soon as we hear something from that. And with that being said, this week's episode, so just to remind everybody, and we walked through Chris's PCR testimony where he talked about what had happened that day or that through that weekend and why he said what he said in the confessions. And then you got to hear his statements, and then you got to hear word for word what was written in the, what again appears to be a transcript, but really is just a Q&A report of the statement.
Man, I'll tell you what, this episode, what was told in this episode, and I know it's from Chris's point of view, Chris's words, is extremely emotional to me, extremely infuriating. The idea that he was asking for a lawyer repeatedly and was not given one is so unworldly upsetting to me.
How scary is that?
It's terrifying. It's terrifying. Yeah. I was in the car driving, thinking about it myself, putting myself in that position, because we've talked about that. You and I have talked about that. You and I have taught our kids that.
Mm-hmm.
And to think to be put in that position where you're doing what you're supposed to be doing, and the law enforcement is not following the quote unquote rules.
Right. You don't have to put them in quotes. They're the motherfucking rules.
Well,
you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. They're just not, they're not playing by the rules, and you have nothing to do but to do what they want.
It was weird. I know I tried to articulate that in the episode, but like when I was reading it and I was writing, like it hit me in a weird way.
Yeah,
when
it's upsetting.
When it was like, what could you do? Because like you said, you put yourself in that position. It's like, what could you do if a cop pulls you in and says, I need to get a statement from you. And you say, I don't talk to police without a lawyer. I want a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, you ain't getting a lawyer. I want a lawyer. You're not getting a lawyer. You're gonna, and then they're, you know, they have your fiance, you know, in the other room, and then hours and hours and hours and hours and hours go on.
Yeah.
From there, and you just keep saying you want a lawyer, and they and they're not recording anything. Like, at what point, you know, there's all the different ways they can break you, but like, at what point are you just like, what am I gonna, like, there's nothing I can do here.
Yeah. And the scariest idea is with them not recording, there is zero proof.
No way to prove it. Right.
It's my word against yours. And in a, you know, we've all know that where that goes at trial, where that goes anywhere, is everybody tends to lean towards law enforcement as the truth.
Right.
Regardless of what they know. So it's my word against yours. And you may be lying, but it's still my word against yours. And I'm the guy that's the quote unquote bad guy right now, or the guy on trial. So everybody's looking at you like you have to prove your innocence. They don't have to prove anything, even though that's how that doesn't work whatsoever.
Yeah. Yeah. It definitely doesn't.
It was so upsetting. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, Christine in the chat made a good point. She said they are following the rules, and she points out that Colin Miller has cited case law where once a person starts speaking again after they exercise their rights, they have tacitly agreed to continue the interrogation. So that's true, that, that case law does exist. And that's why you'll hear a lot of times where, like in recorded interviews, you'll hear, you know, I think I need a lawyer. First of all, you have to be very explicit. There's also plenty of case law if you're like, I think I should have a lawyer. That doesn't count. You have to say, I want a lawyer. And then if the cops say, you know, all right, you know, if you want a lawyer, we can stop it. I'm just telling you, that's it's going to make you look guilty. You know, we're just trying to help you out here. And if you're like, well, Jamie Snow was a good example of that when in his interrogation. Sandra Melgar in her interrogation, where, you know, they say they want a lawyer, then they start talking again. But the thing is, that is a very different thing than saying, I want a lawyer, and then saying, nope, we are not giving you a lawyer. Because now you're not, now somebody isn't just like essentially waiving their right.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you've told them, I'm not giving you your right. And in Chris's case, if the tricky part, like he said, there's no way to prove it, but based on his retelling of the story, is he insisted that he would not give a statement and wanted an attorney for hours. And this week we're going to get into the exact amount of time all that took, but it was hours of them telling him no before he finally cracked.
That was one of the questions I personally had written down, was the idea that in Chris's statement, he says, or you say, and he says that he came in about noon. They picked him up somewhere in that noon time, and he didn't give a statement until about midnight, right?
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, he's being pressured and pressured and pressured and pressured before he waives his Miranda rights.
Right.
They make him sign a waiver to waive his rights after they show him his girlfriend to prove that she's there. Is there some sort of tangible timestamp to prove when they got him there? Because it doesn't seem that if there's a tangible timestamp, that they could just do that. They could just make you sit there for hours without a Miranda, anything Mirandized.
Yeah. So that's some of the stuff we're going to get into this week. So, because we're going to go through his arrest report. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, with this case, everything's squishy, including times. You know, think of like Larry's statement. There's no times on it. But, you know, all they have to say is that he just never asked for a lawyer, never asked for a lawyer. They Mirandized him, never asked for a lawyer, and they were just talking to him. And again, all they got to do is say he wasn't the suspect. We were just talking to him. He wasn't in custody. That's the big trick. Is they all they have to say is he was free to go the entire time, and he doesn't have to be Mirandized. And then they're only using the statement that came after he was Mirandized and waived his rights, right? So there's so many ways to get around it, but when things aren't recorded, I think it just never occurred to me that this could be a thing.
Yeah,
you know, it somehow it didn't click in my mind that you could tell a cop in an interrogation room, I'm not talking, I want a lawyer, and they could tell you, as Chris says, that's not how this is going to work. You ain't getting a lawyer.
That's disgusting. It hurts. Because, like you said, I mean, we've talked about it. Ad nauseum, we've talked about it. The idea of doing this, and to actually think that they did this to him and just said no. Like, it's disgusting. I can't.
Yeah.
It hurts.
Yeah, and then his version of the story too is they continued to mess with him because you know they as a threat or to kind of make sure he knew that they weren't bluffing, that Donald takes him out, shows him, and the way Chris describes it in the transcript is he looks across the room and just sees Shanita sitting there with like her head in her hands.
Mm-hmm.
Like you obviously had been there a long time and was sitting there in the room. And finally he's like, fine, I'll sign it if you let him go. He says, Donald tells him, fine, you sign it, we'll let her go. He signs it, okay, let her go. And he tells him again, that's not how this is going to work. She can go after you give a statement.
So I have a few more questions before we get into the listener questions that are not covered in the listener questions, I believe.
Okay.
One of them, so in his statement where he's talking about what happened in this confession, he talks about the idea that him and Amp had a struggle at Amp's house and the gun went off and they're trying to portray it as self-defense so he can get off.
Yeah.
But none of the medical evidence aligns with that.
Oh, no, nothing in either statement aligns with any of the evidence.
Like, it's bonkers to me.
Yeah, Amp shot in the back of the head.
Right.
And the statement is that they're struggling face-to-face and the gun accidentally went off.
Yeah, and then the idea that the two women rushed him and he shot them.
Mm-hmm. But he can't remember any of the details about it.
Yeah, but I from what I remember, it's been a few weeks, they're not in a situation where they're like that. One's laying on the floor, one's on the couch, am I correct?
Yeah, well, no, one's laying on, like, a mattress in front of the couch.
Okay, so it doesn't seem like they're in a rushing position.
No, in the angle of where they're like, yeah, there's no way that's how they end up. And then there's little things like I was tempted. The reason I read these to you, and I mentioned this last week, is normally I would do a statement analysis if these were the actual words. If I was doing a statement analysis, I would look at things like, how many times did you shoot her? Oh, I can't remember. I'm not sure. Like these are things that like you do. There's so many big like verbal flags in there that tell you that like he doesn't know like what he's supposed to be saying here. Like, you didn't tell me that detail. You told me I shot her. You didn't tell me how many times I shot her. I don't know the answer to that. But it's not even worth doing a statement analysis because it was just typed up by Galt during the whole process.
So listener Jennifer actually writes in about this, says, I noticed last week the statement included the ladies were described as white Caucasian. Caucasian isn't typically used as casual speech. However, it's used by law enforcement. Another small detail that supports the reading from a prepared statement.
Yeah. Reading from a prepared statement or just the fact that they just typed whatever they wanted to in there.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, like, because again, this isn't really a transcript. And that's very evident by, if you go back to Larry Brooks's statement, you know, where he refers to, you know, well, first Anthony Jeffers came out and did this, and then, you know, and he's used the way he's phrasing things, like anyone, much less a 12-year-old kid who's just telling a story in their own words, wouldn't say Anthony Jeffers then came out. He would say Amp came out.
Right.
You know what I mean? So there's tons of that through every statement we've heard.
Yeah. And Richard kind of has that question, which I think we know the answer to this, but it's how do we know the statement is actually from Chris?
Well, I mean, what we know is that Chris signed it.
Okay.
So if we're just looking at facts, not what Chris says happened, not what anybody else has happened, what we know is they typed out this statement and Chris signed. Now, Chris says he signed it under duress and that's not actually what happened, but that's what we know. We know that when that statement was finished being typed up, if you look at, I know I haven't posted, by Friday, it will be up. It's not up yet. But you'll see, like, every page, they had him sign every page of it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the best we got.
So one thing in the statement that I kind of brought up to you earlier that I noticed and I was surprised there wasn't any questions about it was the idea that in the statement, or when the police start questioning him, they ask him numerous times about different vehicles.
Right.
They ask him about his vehicle. They ask him about his girlfriend's vehicle, what color they are, to describe them, what they are. And then when Amp supposedly shows up with the girls in a vehicle, they never talk about the vehicle. And this should be the vehicle that's left at the ball field based on the story.
Right.
Because in his story, they drive to the ball field, the girls get out, he shoots one of them, he ends up shooting the other one, they drag him off, which we also know is not how that occurred.
Also, he said that we drug him through the grass.
Yes, through the grass.
And it was snow on the ground.
And then they walked back to Amp's house.
Mm-hmm.
So if that is accurate, it should be the car that we know is left there. But he's never once asked to describe anything about the car.
Yeah, and that was a good guess. We talked earlier before we were on the air, and I hadn't caught that because they did, in the first statement, ask him to describe the car that Terrell and Shaky and the two girls left in.
Mm-hmm.
But in this one, you're right. They never ask, which, you know, what it indicates to me is they're not actually fact-finding in this interview. Right? So, there's a narrative. They're trying to get the points of their narrative through. But if they were truly trying to fact-find,
mm-hmm.
like, okay, you drove to the ball field with Amp. What car were you in? What did it look like?
Mm-hmm. But by there being a car there, this fits the narrative.
Right. So that's all that mattered.
Right.
Yeah. But yeah, it's definitely a huge indicator that there was definitely no attempt to actually gather facts.
So there's a question I have, but I know that there's one from a few listeners too. I know that I'm not the only one, and I know that Sarah, it's written in here that Sarah's asked us, but she's not the only one either. Do we know if Chris knew any of these five victims?
I don't know. I think it's reasonable to assume based on like what was in the statement that maybe he did know Amp. Oh, and I only say that because it seemed like everybody kind of knew Amp.
It does seem like that
And Chris didn't live in Etna, in that neighborhood,
mm-hmm.
but I think at some point he had lived there. But I don't know for a fact. And when we go through some of his other statements, you know, his like PCR statements, we're actually hearing his words. I'll be able to answer that better, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, it does seem like he's at least familiar with Amp.
My suspicion is that he did, yeah, have some familiarity with Amp. I don't buy that he knew Liz. Tasha didn't know who he was. Tasha didn't know anything about him. Mm-hmm. And then in the first interview, when he talks about Liz, we talked about that last week, how he, like, that keeps growing. Like, oh, she's someone I've seen in the neighborhood. Then it ends up with she's paging him. And, you know, it just keeps, like, going further and further and further down right. the rabbit hole.
Right.
And then it actually gets into, and I'm in the process of digging into this more. I'd said before that none of the phone numbers come back to Chris.
Yeah.
Well, when I was reading through the statements, and I need to check the date and time, because he gives in his statement, he says, oh, well, Liz only had my pager number. And he gives, and they said, what's your pager number? And he gives it. And I'm just, this is kind of a spoiler ahead, but I the reason I'm putting it out there now is because it conflicts with what I had said earlier, and I want to make sure I correct that. In Michelle's statement, Michelle Flores, the house where Sheila and Liz were at before they left.
Okay, yes.
The one who said that she found the piece of paper with Chris written on it and the pager number. In her statement, she says what that number is, and it's the same number as Chris's pager number.
Okay.
So there is that connection there. With the caveat, and this is, so I don't want to jump into too many conclusions, because what I want to find out the timing of when those things were taken, when they had the number. And also, if like that would be the smoking gun of all smoking guns, right? If they had a piece of paper in Liz's handwriting that said Chris and Chris's pager number on it, that would have been front and center piece of evidence at trial.
It sure seems like it.
But at trial, they just say that there was a piece of paper with a phone number written on it.
Okay.
Right. So they don't present it. We don't see it. It's not an evidence. What I did see in Michelle's report where it's typed out, right? Same type of thing, not recorded. It's typed out as a transcript, but it's not a transcript. It says this number in it, and it says the piece of paper, it says C attached, as though they had the piece of paper. But it's not attached. And it wasn't an exhibit at trial, and it wasn't put forward. So
that's weird.
According to these two documents, her statement and Chris's statement, it was his pager number. But no one knows.
Yeah, and you're right. I mean, if that is clearly it is lined up, but if that is like the timing lines up, why would you not put that forward?
Yeah. So I suspect. But this is just my speculation. I suspect when you put those pieces together, that her statement that's not a statement that's just typed up, and his statement that's not a statement that's typed up, both say this number, and they say it's on this piece of paper, and then at trial, the defense is never given that piece of paper. It never comes out in the, it never comes out at trial. They never even say the number at trial. That my suspicion is either the piece of paper didn't exist, or there was a paper that did exist that had a different phone number on it.
Oh, shit.
And they just wrote, and they just said that it was the same number.
That's an interesting theory.
Yeah. So that's just, that's a little extra. It doesn't really have too much to do with this episode, but it just conflicts with what I had said earlier, because that's what I had been, you know, I had been told is that there's no connection to any phone numbers. I'm like, wait a minute. Yes, there is.
Yeah. Yeah, that's wild.
Hey, everybody. Bob here. I'm interrupting this ad break to tell you how you can never have to hear another ad and take a huge step towards helping us continue our work all at the same time. As most of you know, I provide all investigative and advocacy services to the people and attorneys that we cover on the show completely free. Over the years, we provided hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of professional investigations to the wrongfully convicted, completely free of charge. And the reason that we're able to do that is in large part thanks to the support of listeners like you. Our Patreon community funds the overwhelming majority of our work, and I want to take this opportunity to ask and encourage you to join the club. The base level membership is just $5 a month. Now, while that's only a cup of coffee's worth out of your account, it makes all the difference in the world to us and the people that we work with. And for your $5 a month, you get a whole list of extra content, exclusive just for patrons. Every week, Janet, Zach, and I do an hour-long live stream just for our patrons. You also get an unedited video version of the Friday follow-up every week, a weekly pregame podcast that drops into your podcast feed. Patrons often get to participate in interviews that we do on the show live days or weeks before the rest of the audience gets to hear them. And of course, the best part, all of our content is completely ad-free for our patrons at the $5 a month level. Patreon really is the only way that we're able to keep doing this work. And it would mean the absolute world to me, Zach, Janet, and Erica if you'd consider joining if you're able to do so. Joining the Patreon community is super easy. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. Or you can go right to the episode description of this or any episode and just click the link. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts for your support. And now I'll return you to your regularly scheduled ads.
Sarah also asks, do we know where Chris was on the night of the murders? Was he with Terrell and Shaky?
He was with Shaky. So there's many, many, many witnesses that confirm that Chris was at the pool hall with Shaky, and that there was an argument. After that, according to Chris, Chris just went home. So that was the end of it. So nothing else after that point is true. So the one place we know where he was throughout the majority of the evening was at the pool hall.
And do we have
at the VFW?
And do we have any sort of timeline on that?
We'll get into that.
Perfect. Liz says, were you able to find out any information if there was other people named Chris in Amp and Liz's circle of friends?
So far, no. Tasha, when we talked to her, she wasn't familiar with any Chris's that she could think of. There is going to be another Chris.
Okay.
But as far as if that person actually was connected to the victims, I don't know if there was a connection there or not.
And I know that this has probably been answered before, but I'm going to follow up. Liz also asked, do you anticipate speaking directly with Larry at any point?
I don't. I want to. So I mentioned a few weeks ago that I was texting back and forth with Amp's son. And Amp's son is still friends with Larry. And my understanding is Larry doesn't want anything to do with any of this. My hope has been to get, we keep having like text exchanges with Amp's son, and we're scheduling a time to talk, and then it just never happens. But my hope is if I can talk to Amp, and if he realizes that, you know, I'm not here to just get somebody out of prison, that I'm trying to truly find the person that killed his dad.
Mm-hmm.
If we can get to a place where he trusts me that maybe he can make that connection, and you know, whether it's for an interview or not, you know, on the air interview or not, I would just love to talk to Larry. So I would like to. As of now, my understanding is that he doesn't have any desire to talk about the case at all. And actually, if you read the transcript from his deposition, he says as much. He's like, I never want to talk about this again.
Okay. Susan in the chat asks, will we hear from people that were at the VFW pool hall? Was there an argument, and how did they seem?
I don't know. That's the goal, right? So for those of you that are unfamiliar with kind of our process, you know, we're going through the facts of the case, we're going through the original investigation, we're going through the trial, and then we start launching the new investigation. I'm looking for where are leads for people for us to talk to try to get more information. So that's on the docket for me. Once I have the full picture and know the right questions to ask, is to try to contact those witnesses that were at the pool hall.
Vivian says, I just caught up on all the episodes and I apologize for taking a step back. Is it possible that the reload or load that was supposedly heard at the house of the murderer may have been just prior to the shootings and was talking about loading up whatever they're using to smoke the drugs? Just curious what everybody thinks.
It's a good thought. Yeah, I mean, I'm not familiar enough with smoking crack cocaine to know if that's a thing.
Yeah, I don't know either, but I've never heard that terminology, but also I'm not in that world.
Yeah. Well, and if we back up a little bit, I believe the statement we get from Larry, which we know there's problems with that statement, mm-hmm. is that there was several shots, then he heard them say, put another shell in. Yeah. So no, I don't think so.
Okay. Colin asks, will the statements from the last two episodes be uploaded to the case documents?
Yeah. So they'll be up by Friday. I've had a crazy couple of weeks, and there was a lot of personal information in them. So I had to go through and redact them, and it just wasn't a super high priority because I literally read them to you verbatim. So there's nothing in them that you haven't heard, but right before Zach got here, I got one of them redacted. I'm working on the other ones. So I should have those up here in the next day or so.
Perfect. Sarah says, seeing as there was three people named on the tip, why would police focus on Chris instead of Shaky or Terrell?
Well, good question. And I mean, to me, the answer is simple, because I don't think they cared about actually solving the case. Mm. So if we look at like what we learned over these last two episodes, according to Chris, right? So they bring Chris in. Chris gives this nonsense statement that we know isn't true. Sounds like based on the tip, right? So he names Shaky and Terrell as part of it. Brings Shaky in. Shaky says he was with Chris, but then he left and doesn't know what happened after that. According to Chris, then they showed Shaky Chris's statement, put them both out in the yard together, where Shaky then threatened him if he didn't take his name out of the statement. And then Chris came and gave essentially a confession that didn't involve Shaky or Terrell in the second one. So if you're looking at, if you got cops that just want to close a case, that's as far as they ever went, right? So they got somebody that gave a statement that said, yeah, I accidentally shot Amp and then I shot the two girls. Case closed. They let Shaky go and that was the end of it.
So I'm thinking about this in real time, so forgive me. The statement where Chris says that they showed Shaky his statement and then the next morning or whatever, released them both in the yard so they could have this discussion.
Mm-hmm.
That would mean that Shaky was detained.
He was detained. So Shaky was arrested.
Okay.
And they locked him up just kind of overnight. I don't know if it was an actual arrest or it was just they can hold him for 24 hours, whatever it is. But he was locked up. And what Chris says Shaky told him was, they have to let me go.
Okay.
And you know what's going to happen when I get out of here.
So I was under the impression that Shaky came in, gave his statement, and left.
No, he was detained for that 24-hour period or whatever. Okay.
So I did not know that going into this. All right. Jennifer says, have the officers on this case who investigated it, had any of the cases reviewed for misconduct? Is this a pattern for them? And in the same vein, Ellen asked, do we know if any of these detectives are still working in law enforcement?
I have an episode planned for kind of the Gary Police Department and the corruption around this time in general. We're going to be digging into that. So I don't have those answers right now, but that's slated for us to spend a whole episode digging into all that stuff.
Oh, that'd be interesting. Kaylee asks, if Chris has admitted that the first trip to Amp's house to confront him about saying his name selling drugs is true or not?
No. So in the statement, he admits it.
Mm-hmm.
Outside of that, no, he does not. So, because I think that question like is going on to say like what parts of the statement are true and how
yeah,
much.
Yeah, so I was just curious if every part of it was false or just the second time that he saw Amp.
Yeah. So is according to Chris, the only part of that statement that's true is that there was an argument at the VFW with Shaky. Everything after that was fabricated.
Okay. Because it is interesting that he talks in both statements about going to Amp's house. Well, to confront him.
Well, look at that. If you're of the mindset of these are corrupt cops,
mm-hmm.
and I'm not saying you should be, but if you are, so look at the how this plays out. They get him to give this statement that he went there and he saw Terrell murder the three people in the house, and then Terrell and Shaky leave with the other two girls. Okay, so then they bring Shaky in.
Mm-hmm.
And so as part of that statement, there's first this argument with Amp. They leave and come back, right? So then they bring Shaky in. And Shaky now gives a statement that says, hey, I've got him. I can put him at Amp's house having an argument with Amp. So now you've got something that confirmed, but I've got nothing to do with it. So they bring Chris back in to give a new version of the statement where he actually is confessing to him being culpable. There's that one consistent piece that they keep going through it, right? So Chris has already admitted that he had an argument with Amp, that he was there when there was an argument with Amp. Now, Shaky says there was an argument with Amp. So it's not surprising to me that the argument with Amp shows up in the third statement too, but then everything else changes.
Interesting, interesting.
Because that then jives with Shaky's statement, which allows Shaky to be released.
Okay. And it is strange to me that Terrell is brought up in the tip. Terrell is brought up in Chris's statement. Terrell's never brought up in Shaky's statement.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole Terrell thing is very interesting. And I think that leads us into our last question, which comes from Patricia, is, was Terrell ever spoken to by police regarding the murders?
That is a perfect segue into Sunday's episode. Because so this week's episode is going to be kind of a hodgepodge trying to fill in all these gaps, right? So we're going to hear about Shanita's arrest, Shanita's statement. We're going to hear about the rest of the story that Chris gave in that PCR deposition about what happened before and after he gave the statement. And we're also going to hear about the fact that Terrell was arrested and brought into the station and what happened with that. You'll get all that on Sunday. Make sure you tune into that, and we'll talk all about it in the follow-up next week.
See you guys.
Bye, guys.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production. Co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X at Truth Justice Pod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.